This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. Neal Conan is on vacation. Even if you've never read the entire Declaration of Independence, there's one part of it that is indelibly printed on our national psyche, and that is that among our inalienable rights are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Life and liberty are easy enough concepts to grasp, but what exactly did the Founding Fathers mean by happiness? A New York Times column exploring that question recently piqued our interest. We wondered what Americans think when they hear that phrase. Here's a sampling of opinion from visitors at the Jefferson Memorial today.
The pursuit of happiness was not in wealth or possessions, but I believe it was in the pursuit of life and what life actually meant.
The ability and the freedom to chase your own dreams, whatever they might be.
It's a deep question. Find like peace and joy, like just kind of like the perfect place to live.
The pursuit of your dreams, the things that God placed in your heart for you to go forth and do, I think that's what the pursuit of happiness is, because you truly attain happiness when you obtain your dreams, and that's what being an American is all about, I think.
What happiness means to Dale Perkins from Longview, Texas, Mark Fetterman of Chadsford, Pennsylvania, Travis Wright of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and Onda Berger from Flint, Michigan. When Jefferson sat down at his writing table in the muggy spring of 1776, he was thinking of the pursuit of happiness as a political concept, a state of being that citizens could expect, even demand, their government to provide. This hour, the pursuit of happiness, what it means and its influence on our nation. As we prepare to celebrate the 4th of July, what are your thoughts about that phrase in the Declaration of Independence? Should government be involved with our happiness? And how do you balance contradictory claims of happiness among citizens? Join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Joining me now from the shores of Narragansett Bay in Rhode Island is Pauline Mayer. She's a professor of history at American University and also the author of American Scripture, Making the Declaration of Independence. Thanks for joining us from your vacation, Professor Mayer.
Thank you. I'm actually at MIT.
Oh, you're at MIT. Well,
not at American University.
At MIT. Thanks so much for correcting me on that. Before we begin, perhaps you could give us something of a primer of the political and philosophical influences that shaped the thinking of our founding fathers as they wrote the Declaration of Independence.
The principles in the second paragraph of the Declaration of Independence were by no means unique to that document. In fact, when people in 1776 read the document, my sense is that their eyes skipped over that. It looked like basically boilerplate, their ideas they'd heard in other places, and they weren't what was unique about the Declaration of Independence. What they quoted most often were not those lines, but the end of the document, which actually proclaims independence. We look at those documents and we wonder at those sentences, and they seem very important to us. And I think that reflects a change in the use of the document over time. And the pursuit of happiness is one idea that I think has evoked considerable puzzlement, because we know what life and liberty is, basically. But what does happiness mean? And my sense is that in the 18th century, the phrase was particularly understood with reference to government. My usual answer to this question, what did Jefferson mean, is that he meant to say in a more compressed manner what George Mason had said in a draft of the Virginia Declaration of Rights that had appeared in the Pennsylvania Gazette on June 11th, probably just before Jefferson and the committee sat down to work. Can I read Mason's words?
Sure, go ahead.
It sounds familiar to us, but they're slightly different, that all men are born equally free and independent and have certain inherent natural rights of which they cannot by any compact deprive or divest their posterity, among which are the enjoyment of life and liberty with the means of acquiring and possessing property and pursuing and obtaining happiness and safety, And it's interesting that, that Mason goes back to the idea of happiness a little later. Of all the various modes and forms of government, that is best, which is capable of producing the greatest degree of happiness and safety.
Well, it's interesting, too, that happiness appears twice right at the beginning of the Declaration of Independence. And in the second reference, happiness is very much is linked to safety. I mean, were those two closely related in Jefferson's mind?
I think they were, that people could not be content unless they had some security for their rights, including their right of possession to their property. If things were taken away arbitrarily, it would lead to discontent, or what we would call unhappiness. I wrote a book on the Declaration of Independence a few years ago called American Scripture. I'm now working on a book on the ratification of the Constitution, and the word happiness still comes up continually. In the letters of George Washington, he keeps talking about a government which will serve the happiness of the American people. That's what he wants to see established in this country.
And Jefferson, in borrowing from George Mason's Virginia Declaration of Rights, he dropped the right to own property but kept the pursuit of happiness.
I think he basically folded in the right of acquiring property. Jefferson had the task of writing a much more succinct statement of what Mason said. That whole first sentence of the second paragraph, and I should say it's much longer than what we remember, but the entire sentence was constructed according to an 18th century rhetorical form that consisted of a series of phrases, one piled on the other, the meaning of which became clear only at the end. And if you read that sentence in that, looking for it, it becomes quite clear that's how it's constructed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed with certain by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted, etc. And at the conclusion of it is what we've forgotten. Basically, it's the assertion of the right of revolution. The whole series was meant to establish the right of revolution. People create governments to protect their rights. If the governments destroy the rights, the people have a right to alter or to change them and to found another one that would, in their opinion, better secure their safety and happiness. So he ends with the right of revolution. It's interesting that I think in memory we chop that whole sentence off in the middle with the statement that governments are created to protect these rights. If that then becomes the meaning of the sequence, the meaning is changed substantially. It's a charge to an established government, not the basis of a revolutionary manifesto. Governments are created to protect our inalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
It's like
a Bill of Rights.
Yeah, and in saying that, I'm wondering if part of the reason that there's a disconnect in the modern mind regarding the pursuit of happiness and a governmental role in that is that perhaps we are comfortable enough that perhaps we don't understand what it means to live under a government where a good government is a precondition for happiness.
We are not obsessed with founding a government that would support our security and happiness. We assume we've had it. We've had it for 200 years. But this is it's a blessing to have that assumption. I remember actually a conversation I had with a cab driver in Washington who was an immigrant from Africa. And we had one of those conversations that you don't think about because you're thinking about something else, you know, the little tidbits. And it was a cold day, and I said, it's not very nice here. And she said, made some comment, and I said, where are you from? And she said, Africa. I said, it's warmer there. She said, but it's better here. And I said, what do you mean better? And I wasn't really, you know, again, it was a conversation I wasn't paying much attention to. And she said, I like the Constitution. You know, it was not the statement I was expecting.
Uh-huh.
She said, and I like equal rights. She had come from a country where none of those things were to be presumed.
Yeah.
And it was better here for her. Sometimes we have to listen to immigrants to understand the beginnings of our country.
Yeah. I'd like to take a call. Ryan in Sacramento, California. Hello. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hi. I just want to say that the actual phrase, life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, it was taken almost word for word from John Locke. It wasn't stealing. I mean, everyone knew who John Locke was back then. It was, like you said earlier, from that other document, it was a... life, liberty, and the pursuit of property. What they meant by happiness then, it was more the pursuit of your livelihood, what job you wanted, and that the government couldn't tell you what you wanted to do with your life. If you go into Europe at that time, a person, like a family, had the entire job until, like, it'd be a carpenter or something like that.
Yes.
It would be illegal for them. They wouldn't be allowed to transfer a job unless they got permission from the government. Or there'd be some jobs that, like a tax collector, that would be considered dirty. And then no Christian would be allowed to do that. Only a Jew or a Muslim, whichever one's managed to be there, would end up taking that job. So pursuit of happiness, it was meant more, you could do whatever you wanted with your life, whatever job you wanted.
That there were fewer restrictions. You're certainly correct that the more standard formulation and that which appears in Locke is life, liberty, and property. Our documents just don't happen to use that triad. And happiness, I mean, in a sense, the pursuit of happiness, what does it mean? Well, I think that the references, as I've been arguing, largely with reference to government, but there are scholars who say that what Jefferson meant was to let people pursue happiness however they defined it for themselves.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes, exactly that. Primarily it was because of when like their jobs, but if you don't want it, like you can do and work and live your life however you want it, which basically it was. The government doesn't have any right to tell you how to live your life, which is basically it.
All right, thanks for your call, Ryan. But Professor Mayer, is Ryan simplifying that a little bit? I mean, isn't there a notion of happiness as that the collective good is a precondition for happiness also?
I think so. I think there's an understanding that certainly among most of the revolutionaries that the best understanding, your private good understood correctly, demanded that you look for the good of everyone, that your best interests are in the good of the community, and that should be your main objective. On the other hand, they often thought that pursuing their individual ambitions was a good way of serving the public. I look at a lot of laws in the 1780s, and they're, you know, the legislatures are passing patents, and some of the earliest creating some of the corporations in this country. And they will say that an individual wants to form some kind of, a knife factory, for example, and that for them to do this will serve the public welfare, and it will certainly serve the interests of the individual, but it serve the interests of the public as well. Individual interest and public interest went hand in hand, more often than not.
Was there any notion then that conflicting ideas of happiness would lead to political clashes, as I think we see in...
Oh, surely. And we see it today.
Yes.
I mean, the way people cite this phrase is sometimes almost comic. A colleague once sent me a story about a clammer in Maine who had been excluded from the beds where he liked to dig for clams because they were in an adjoining town that had decided only its citizens could dig clams there. And he said this was absolutely illegal, that it made him unhappy, and he had a right to the pursuit of happiness, and the Constitution was on his side. We often get these documents confused, but that the pursuit of happiness gave him a right to dig in the clam beds of an adjoining town was a rather peculiar application of the right. But, hey, that's the way he thought about it.
Okay. Pauline Mayer is the author of American Scripture, Making the Declaration of Independence. She's also a professor of American history at MIT. We're talking about the Declaration of Independence and the pursuit of happiness. What is the role of this right in our government and our lives? We're taking your calls at 800-989-TALK. That's 800-989-8255. Send us an email. The address is totn@npr.org. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. We're talking about Americans' inalienable right to the pursuit of happiness, as the Declaration of Independence lays it out for us. What specific rights do you think are protected by that phrase? Our guests are Pauline Mayer, author of American Scripture, Making of the Declaration of Independence. And joining us now to help explore the concept of happiness through the ages is Darren McMahon, Associate Professor of European History at Florida State University and author of a forthcoming History of Happiness. He comes to us from the studios of member station WGCU in Fort Myers, Florida. Thanks for being with us, Professor McMahon.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
And you are also invited to join the discussion. Give us a call at 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. Professor McMahon, when did the word happiness come into common use in the English language?
In the English language, when English is created, as it were, in the sort of middle to high Middle Ages, and it's actually interesting because the root of the term happiness is hap, and just by coincidence, the production assistant here, the radio station where I am, is named Hap, and as he knows, it's a word that that Shakespeare uses, and it means happen or chance or luck. It actually comes from Old Norse. It's interesting because the word for happiness in every Indo-European language, going all the way back to the ancient Greek and Latin as well, is cognate with luck, chance, sometimes fate. And I find that extremely interesting because essentially the notion is, and you get this in sort of Greek tragedy and you get this still today in many traditional cultures, is that happiness is not something that you have control over. Happiness is something that happens to you. If you're lucky, if the gods are smiling fondly upon you, if the stars are well aligned, well, then you may be happy, but you can't really control it, and moreover, you never know what's going to happen. So there's that famous great Greek phrase from Greek tragedy, call no man happy until he's dead, because, you know, things may be going well, and then a piano will fall on your head, and it's all over.
Mm-hmm.
So one thing that is so important and revolutionary about not just Jefferson's use of the word happiness in the 18th century, but broader 18th century Enlightenment use, is that people in the 18th century assumed, really for the first time in human history, that happiness was something that we had a right to and that we could attain through our own efforts, that we could control. And arguably that notion can only arise in cultures in which you have some basic control over things like Professor Mayer mentioned earlier, security.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can prevent pianos from falling on your head. You can prevent people from, you know, rolling into town and marauding and raping and pillaging and so forth.
And government would have a role in that as well?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Right. In setting the conditions for that. So I just wanted to add something in defense of John Locke. He never uses the phrase life, liberty, and property. He speaks of life, liberty, and fortune, and life, liberty, and estate. But he does say talk about the pursuit of happiness at great length, in not in the two treatises on government, which are often cited, but in a book he wrote called The Essay Concerning Human Understanding, in which he tries to explain how it is that we know things in the world, and he puts forth this famous idea of the tabula rasa, that the mind is like a blank slate. In one chapter in that book, he talks about happiness, and he uses the metaphor of gravity. And he says that we pursue happiness in effect like an object is drawn by gravitational force. Jefferson certainly knew that use. It was, you know, widely known in the 18th century. And he's making there a pretty commonplace assertion that if objects aren't impeded, if nothing gets in their way, then their natural course is towards pleasure, towards happiness.
Mm-hmm.
And so the role of government is to keep people from, or keep other people from getting in the way. So, you know, back to your notion earlier about whether there's conflict involved here. Certainly the government's role is to try to prevent that so that people can follow their own natural course.
You've been quoted as saying, though, that the pursuit of happiness as a civic duty has become a burden. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, it's funny. We always focus, of course, on the word happiness and the pursuit of happiness. But it's interesting to look at the other word in 18th century English, pursuit. If you go look up pursue or pursuit in Samuel Johnson's 18th century Dictionary of the English Language, you'll find the definition of to pursue says to chase or to follow in hostility. And pursuit is the act of following with hostile intention. There's a close link there between pursuit and persecute. In fact, in Scottish law in the 18th century, a prosecutor, what we think of today as a public prosecutor, was called a pursuer. And I find that extremely interesting, because pursuing happiness then is following happiness with hostile
intent. With a vengeance.
Right, exactly. Uh-huh. Now, I would argue that there's a really interesting sort of link here in the Christian tradition, which of course is so tremendously important in the 18th century context too, and that is that happiness from the Beatitudes forward is associated directly with God. And St. Augustine, for example, writes his first book, the De Beata Vita, on the Blessed Life, on happiness, on how to get to happiness. And what he argues there is that we can't get there because of original sin.
Hmm.
We'll only know happiness. We're pilgrims in this world. We're searching, constantly pursuing. We'll only know happiness, if at all, when we get God's grace and when we arrive at God. So what I find interesting about that is that for Augustine, the constant yearning and longing and desire for happiness is in some ways a bother, a burden, because it's a constant reminder of our sin, of our inability to arrive at happiness on our own, of the original fall and transgression in the garden with Adam and Eve. Happiness then and the desire for it is a constant reminder that we're insufficient on our own.
And if we're unhappy, it's our own darn fault then. we're to blame.
Well, that's the thing that's so interesting about the, in some ways about, right, I mean, there's guilt there, but it is so interesting about the 18th century move is that it does make you responsible for happiness, really, for the first time. Hmm. You can't just say, well, you know, bad luck, or you can't just say, you know, God didn't choose me, I'm not one of the elect. Now you have to say, well, you know, maybe there's something wrong with me. And I would argue that, you know, when we live in a culture today in which you open a magazine and all you do is see a smiling person, everyone you see on television is claims to be happy, you know, we're still uncomfortable about admitting depression, and What sort of message do people get? Well, if they're not happy, then something's wrong with them. Yeah. And that, you know, maybe they should be in therapy or taking an SSRI or something to that effect. And so there's the dark side, as it were,
okay, a
shadow side.
We're talking about the pursuit of happiness. If you'd like to join us, the number's 1-800-989-8255. And let's go to Jerry. Hi, Jerry.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Oh, well, in everything he just said, I was called to comment about.
What were you going to say?
That the happiness just basically has to do with luck and chance and odds, and I would think as it goes in the end of declaration, it would be pursuing or to making your own odds, which before that you didn't have the ability an individual person did.
Do you feel like it's a bit of a burden to feel that you should be pursuing happiness and perhaps should be happy in our society?
Not at all.
What does it mean to you?
To have one's own luck, to make one's own luck, rather than to have have luck forced upon you from above.
To improve your own odds, right?
Pardon me?
To improve your own odds.
To improve yourself, to improve others, to improve your society, your community, the world for that matter. And I would think today the happiness is more along the lines of good luck instead of bad luck.
Okay, thanks so much for your call, Jerry. That's pretty much in keeping with much of what you have been saying, Professor McMahon, but with a very, I sense, it's kind of with a very American twist in the sense of you
sure.
make your own luck.
Right. Absolutely. And again, it is American, although it's funny, when I talk about this in Europe, you often, you know, European audience will like to say that Americans are blithe and they smile all the time and, you know, they don't take life seriously enough, they don't know its true horror and so forth. And I'm forced to point out that when Jefferson says the pursuit of happiness is a self-evident truth, it resonated with European audiences as much as it would have with American, because the broader movement that Jefferson, of course, is a part of, the Enlightenment, the century of lights, the age of reason, is obsessed with happiness. More books are published about happiness in France, in England, in Spain, in Italy, in what is now Germany, in the 18th century than any previous period in Western history. And so the Europeans are obsessed with happiness as well. So it's not just peculiarly American. Arguably, it becomes more so after the 18th century. But in the 18th century, it's part of a wider phenomenon. It's no coincidence then that in the French Constitution of the year 3 during the French Revolution, the very first principle is governments are made to secure our own happiness, that the goal of government is to provide happiness, common happiness, bonheur commun.
Okay. Joining us now to talk about the legal ramifications of the Declaration of Independence is Boston University Law Professor Randy Barnett. He's the author of the book, The Structure of Liberty, Justice and the Rule of Law, and he comes to us from the studios of WBUR in Boston. Thanks for being with us today, Professor Barnett. First of all, what's the legal status of the Declaration of Independence, and what are the legal ramifications of this phrase we've been talking about, the pursuit of happiness? Are there any?
Well, some claim that the Declaration is entirely independent of the Constitution. It was something that happened 13 years earlier. There was a war that happened. We had government under the Articles of Confederation in the interim. There really isn't any connection between the Declaration and the Constitution. I thought one thing I could add to this fascinating discussion I've been listening to from Professors Mayer and McMahon is a proposal that James Madison made to the first Congress that he asked to be added to the preamble to the Constitution, along with the rest of the amendments, which were eventually adopted. And here's what he proposed be added: that government is instituted and ought to be exercised for the benefit of the people, which consists in the enjoyment of life and liberty, with the right of acquiring and using property, and generally of pursuing and obtaining happiness and safety. So here you see a reaffirmation of the pursuit of happiness, the pursuing and obtaining happiness, and you notice how pursuit and obtaining happiness are kept distinct there, and also the affirmation of the right of acquiring and using property as a means to that end. And I think the pursuit of happiness could be best thought of as the end for which the rights that are protected by the Bill of Rights and the rest of our Constitution are instituted. They are the means, and the pursuit of happiness is thought to be the end. Oh, I think properly so.
Interesting.
What Madison was doing there was drawing on the words of the Virginia Declaration of Rights that Mason had drafted, with the language that, again, in turn, I think Jefferson condensed in writing the second paragraph of the Declaration of Independence.
Professor Mayer is correct, and in addition, he was drawing upon proposals that were made by state ratification conventions to have this or similar language added to the
right.
Constitution, which themselves were copies of the earlier versions that she's talking about.
And let me just ask you something, Professor Barnett. In terms of the legal ramifications of this, do we see it in the cases where, as we were talking about before, where notions of happiness clash, where one's idea of happiness clashes with another's idea of happiness? Is that where it might come into our legal system in any way?
Well, if we have a properly defined set of rights, then those rights will allow individuals to pursue different conceptions of happiness while living in close proximity to each other. So all the action is in how we properly define our rights, and that's one of the reasons why the founders believed that the rights of life, liberty, and property were so crucial. So, because if they were properly defined, then people could use those rights as the means to pursue different visions of happiness. And the Greeks, as well as all the classical thinkers, although they had certain general observations to be made about happiness, they did think happiness was context-specific. You could only speak of happiness in the most abstract of terms, but when it came to real life, it all depended on the particularities of time and place. Our founders understood that as well.
Randy Barnett is a professor of law at Boston University, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. If you'd like to join our discussion, the number is 1-800-989-8255. Let's take a call from Jackie in Buford, South Carolina. Hi, Jackie.
Hello. Hello. How are you?
Good. Go ahead.
The comment that I have goes back in some part to the discussion you were having earlier about an individual's pursuit of happiness being also good for society at large, but it expands on that beyond what could just be an economic piece to what is perhaps the philosophical underpinnings of what America is, and that is in this way. The Constitution was written by people like Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin, and these are men who, in the pursuit of those things that delight them, in their pursuit of their individual delight or happiness, expanded our whole realm of ideas about what is possible in science, architecture, agriculture, householding, business, the huge range of activities that just these two men, among the many drafters, shared. And I believe that in putting the pursuit of happiness into the Constitution, they placed a mechanism by which we could, as a society, evolve to become what I like to think is uniquely American, an ever-evolving dynamic of ideas and beliefs, and even to the most basic idea of freedom, which is what this piece was all about for these fellows.
Professor Mayer, could you respond?
Well, first of all, the pursuit of happiness is not in the Constitution; it's in the Declaration of Independence.
Well, of course, I'm sorry.
But I think we have made it. I think the confusion is very interesting because I find it's very widely spread in this country. I had a number of people came up to me after I published a book on the Declaration of Independence said, "Oh, you're the woman that wrote the book on the Constitution." And it went from library workers to lawyers to others. And I think there's a reason we make that confusion. We have that confusion. It has to do with the way we have reread the second paragraph to think of it as a statement of rights that our government is supposed to protect. We made it like a Bill of Rights, and of course the Bill of Rights is part of the Constitution, so we think of them as all basically one thing. So it isn't an unintelligent confusion, but I think it's a very common one.
Well, I think that preamble of the Declaration is an affirmation of the rights by which government is to be judged. The Declaration had a different purpose than the Constitution. The Declaration was like what today we would call an indictment in a criminal case. It's a statement, a formal statement of grievances such that would justify a revolution. And not any grievances will justify a revolution, but grievances that constitute a long train of abuse amounting to what we would today might call a criminal conspiracy against the rights of the people would justify a revolution. So you have to affirm what the rights of the people are against which government is to be judged in order to justify separation. But those rights don't vanish when you establish subsequent governments, and they didn't vanish when we established the Constitution.
It's true, but our attention to that part of the Declaration of Independence came quite late. The 1790s, after the Constitution had been ratified, and indeed after the first 10 amendments had been ratified, I strongly suspect that had Madison's preamble or prefix been added to the Constitution, or better yet, had the suggestion of George Mason in the waning days of the Philadelphia Convention that a Bill of Rights be added to the Constitution been approved, that the Declaration would have nowhere near the prominence it has in American consciousness.
Thanks so much, Professor Pauline Mayer, for joining us today. We're going to take a short break. Pauline Mayer is the author of American Scripture, Making the Declaration of Independence. She's also a professor of American history at MIT. And remember, the annual July 4th reading of the full Declaration of Independence, featuring many of NPR's hosts and reporters, will air tomorrow on Morning Edition. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. Join guest host Joe Palca on the next Science Friday for a helping of Summertime Science for the 4th. Today, we're talking about the right to pursue happiness. The phrase comes from the Declaration of Independence, and we're talking about how those words still shape our political and legal thinking. Our guests are Randy Barnett, a law professor at Boston University, and Darren McMahon, associate professor of European history at Florida State University and author of a forthcoming History of Happiness. We have time for one more call, so let's go to Laura in Cleveland, Ohio. Hi, Laura.
Hi.
Go ahead.
There's another quote that's in the Jefferson Memorial that just really sums it up for me. It's more of a mental aspect to the pursuit of happiness. And I'm not sure if I have this right, so forgive me if I screw up the word order, but it's something to the effect of, "I swear upon the altar of God eternal hostility for tyranny in any form over the mind of man." And when I think about the Declaration of Independence, the Bill of Rights, our Constitution, and the way all these components work together, that's one of the central concepts to me, the fact that I can think the way I want to think, that I can have my own beliefs and I can act upon them. And that is what is guaranteed me here.
And that is what brings you happiness, or that is your idea of political happiness?
Mm-hmm. It affects every form, everything that you do. If you don't have the ability to think how you want to think and to come up with your own beliefs and ideals and act upon them, then you're limited in doing anything. It is central.
All right, thanks for that. And I'm going to ask our guest to respond. Professor McMahon, Darren McMahon first.
Well, I think this is just so critical. And I find it fascinating, actually, that Jefferson chose, in sort of adapting the quote that Professor Mayer mentioned from George Mason, not to include the phrase obtaining happiness. There's actually an apocryphal quote that you can find on the internet attributed to Benjamin Franklin. He didn't actually say this. The quote is something to the effect that the Declaration promises, guarantees the pursuit of happiness, but not you have to find it for yourself. He didn't say that, but the sentiment, I think, is absolutely correct. That Jefferson allows us, the Declaration allows us to define happiness for ourselves, and this is very different than if you look at what happens in the French Revolution, where happiness is again considered something the government is supposed to provide, but the definition is also provided by the government, and happiness can get tyrannical very quickly. And as the guest points out quite rightly, this is something that Jefferson was trying at all costs to avoid.
Darren McMahon, Associate Professor of European History at Florida State University, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Randy Barnett, I'm going to give you the last word here on happiness.
Well, it's the pursuit of happiness, not just happiness, and that puts the emphasis on action, something that it's not just thought. It's not just imagining what would make you happy or what you want to do, but the ability to put those thoughts into action and pursuing things actively. And it's the rights of life, liberty, and property that give you, properly defined, that give you the means by which one can pursue or can actually act according to one's vision of happiness. And when the government interferes with those actions unduly and without adequate justification, then that puts in jeopardy the underlying basis for which we have the government in the first place.
Randy Barnett, thanks for joining our discussion on the pursuit of happiness. You and all the guests have made me very happy today. Thanks. Randy Barnett is a law professor at Boston University and author of The Structure of Liberty, Justice, and the Rule of Law.